Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of the Golden Arrow series, looking back at the history of the BDO World Championship, this time with the Australian legend Russell Stewart. Rusty was the dominant force in Australian darts in the 1980s and the early 1990s. He won the Australian Masters 5 times, the Australian Grandmaster 6 times, and the Pacific Masters 3 times. Russell reached the Tokyo World Grand Prix final in 1988, at the time the richest competition in the sport, and he was the first man to beat Phil Taylor on television that year as well. He played in 11 BDO World Championships and 1 PDC World Championships, and he reached a career-high ranking of world number 2 in late 1989. He really was a trailblazer and a phenomenal player to boot, and it was a pleasure to chat with him just over a week ago. So I hope you enjoy. Welcome, everybody, to episode 13 in the Golden Arrow series, looking back at the BDO World Championship, and I'm delighted to be joined by one of Australia's all-time greats, Russell Stewart. How are you, Russell?
How do you do, Andrew? Yeah, I'm fine, thank you, mate.
And how's the lockdown been for you?
Well, it hasn't been too bad. I've been working for about 3 months. I had a small contract, but I'm back home now. And like everybody else, just pushing our way through it. I'll be so glad when it's over.
Yeah, I think we can all share that. And looking at your darting career, when was it that you actually started playing darts?
I started playing probably back in 75. My father made the Australian team around 74 and put a board up at home. And he came in one day, and here I am chucking darts from the other side of the kitchen through into the dartboard. He wasn't impressed, but he said, "Look, this is how you throw it properly." And he showed me what to do, how it all worked, and I played for a little while in these couple of events, and I realised I was beating these guys who'd been playing for 10, 20 years. So I just got the taste for it. I just quite enjoyed playing the game.
And am I right in thinking that you were actually born in England?
Yes, I'm a Mancunian, born in Salford. We immigrated what they call over here 10-pound bombs in the early 60s. We came out, and my dad worked from Manchester Steelworks to Wollongong Steelworks over here in Australia, and we all came out for £40. He sold everything up, packed us all in the plane, and out we came. As far as I knew, though, I was Australian. Schooling was all Australian, you know, everything about.
And I mean, in terms of darts, I think the first time that you really, you know, made an impact on the British scene, when you came over and you won the Scottish Open in 1983 and you beat Terry O'Day in the final. I mean, what was that like when you were, you know, a young man coming over and winning a tournament?
Oh, it was, no worries, it was it was just an absolute thrill. I never really thought I'd win it, but what happened basically in the 81, I think it was New Zealand World Cup. And I don't know, I remember listening to you, Wayne saying, we used to watch the videos that used to come out of Jockey and Eric and John and Leighton and Alan Everett, all them guys, you know. And I thought, well, if the World Cup's going to be in New Zealand, I'm going to go over there and watch it. So I went over there in 81 and watched it and just couldn't believe it. I even actually got to play John Lowe in the New Zealand Open. But from then I went, well, that's it. I'm going to be in the next World Cup. And I went home and I played very well. I actually won the Pacific Masters, and it got me to the World Masters in 1982, where I also played in the British Open. I got down to the last 16. I think Peter Locke got me first round on TV. And then I just got the bug from there, you know. I just thought, this is fantastic. 83, then we went to the World Cup in Edinburgh. We played the World Cup. And, of course, I drew Alan Evans first round in the singles. And me and my partner drew John Lowe and Eric Bristow first round in the doubles. I sort of had a lot of luck like that. But the next day I got a chance to get going when they had the tournament afterwards, the Scottish Open. I believe there was 1,450-something players. And I beat players that I like, Jamie Harvey and Keksi Heine Harahu from Finland and Nikki Varashkal. There's a couple of others in there which I sort of duly forget, but couldn't believe it when I got to play Terry in the final, the two Aussies, and had all those people. And, now I went on to win it. So it is a prized possession. It's in the middle of my trophy cabinet.
In the next year, you made your debut at the World Championship. ended in the first round, but what was that whole experience like for you?
Well, I played the first 2 years I played was at Jolly's, Stoke-on-Trent. I'd never, it was just, what can I say, here we are on stage, we're playing, there's people behind having their dinner and having a beer watching us, and it's, you know, packed to the hill. I mean, Jolly's was something. Can't remember who drew the very first game.
I think it was Peter Locke again.
Oh, yeah, he got me back, that's right, he reminded me, he said, oh, you got me in the... I got him actually in the Will Masters to get in the... I think it was the Will Masters to get onto TV. It just happened to be Tony Green and Ollie Croft and they're all watching and me and Lockie were down to the last leg and I took out 1-5-6 to go onto the stage in the Will Masters. And he said, oh, it's my turn. So we sort of had a tete-a-tete going. And no, it was more agog than anything. You know, I was just stunned by it all, you know, the first one.
Mm.
Second year back, I got to play Leighton, won that game, but I lost to Jockey the next round. But my first 2 years was Jolly's, and that was certainly an eye-opener. And then we went on to Lakeside and all the rest of it.
Your win over Leighton was, of course, your first in a World Championship. How special was it to beat a former world champion and one of the great characters of the sport at the time?
Well, it was big for me. In 1978, I think it was, Leighton came out to Australia and was doing exhibitions. I'd never played 1,001 before in my life. We only ever played 501. And I had to play Leighton at 1,001. And I had 106 left, actually, when he went out. And I thought, I didn't do too bad. But I remember then, though, they were playing, the English players played at 7'6", and we were back at 8 foot. This was before the World Darts Federation came in 1980 and came up with the marvellous figure of 7'9¾". And I looked down there and I thought, look at that, I'm giving the guy 6 inches start, you know. I do remember it was, I'd never played such a long game, 1,001 before. So to only have 106 left when he went out, I think I did pretty well.
Mm.
And then actually beat him. Then at Jolly's, and it was just all I was trying to do was just play darts. That's what I love to do, and I was just so happy that I got to beat him. Mm. And then found out later, really too, how such of a icon the man is, you know. But we struck up and had a really good friendship over the years, and I was very lucky to get to know Leighton.
I mean, 1985 was a brilliant year for you in your career. You, of course, you had some more success at the World Masters, which was a bit of a happy hunting ground for you. And you beat Eric Bristow in, I think it was the last 16. And I was watching a video the other day, and it was the highlights of that game. And the interview afterwards, you seemed very awestruck in the moment. Was that the case at the time?
Well, that's what I said. I mean, back in 81 when I went to the World Cup, I mean, we'd only ever seen these guys in videos. And I went to watch the World Cup in New Zealand and watch Eric and John and Cliff, Tony Brown, a jockey, watch them play. And here I am, I'm getting to play Eric, and basically he was the idol. He was a guy, you know, we all wanted to play. And I got him. I was a bit stunned by it all, you know, really. But I think that was also around when Eric started to feel his dartsitis. I don't know. I sort of give him the benefit of the doubt there. You know, I don't think he was at his prime. There's no way in the early 80s, late 70s, where he was just unbeatable. The guy was just unbeatable. But I got to play him. Fortunately for me, I had a winner. So, you know, that kicks it off. Yeah, it does help.
It was still a tremendous victory, though. And then a couple of years later at the World Masters, you beat a certain Phil Taylor, handing him his first ever loss on television. And considering, you know, his incredible career in the sport, that must be a great record to be able to look back on.
Well, yeah, I guess so. There's not too many of us that can say beating Phil Taylor on the telly. I met Phil and Eric in that year in 88 at the Canadian Open. And I was walking down the road, and there was Phil and Eric on the other side, and I bolted over and said, g'day, and he introduced me to Phil, and he said, we're going in for a practice in here, and then we went, had a few games, and Well, Phil went on to win that tournament, that Canadian Open. From there, you know, I mean, I sort of felt, you know, I was holding my own against him. You know, I didn't think much of it when I got the Flame and the World Masters. I thought, yeah, I can beat this guy. Had no idea the monster we were creating at the time, but and that was 1988, and I think it was the next time I played him in the World Championships in 1990. He handed my backside back to me there. I mean, I seen that in my memory, I threw 100, he threw 140, I threw 140, he threw 180, I threw 180, he threw 200. You know, it was just, it was just phenomenal. And then he went on to beat Eric in the final. And, yeah, it was a wonderful thing in the end because when he came out here, we pushed it. Me and Eric, me and Phil went around doing a few exhibitions and we had him, I got to play him a few times again, you know, the man who's conquered him on TV. So I enjoyed it. It was good. It was good.
And, of course, touching on your international career, of course, the World Cup played a key part in shaping your experience. But 1985, the World Cup was in Australia. The new president of the WDF was an Australian. Did you feel any pressure to perform that year?
Of course you do. You're playing against these guys and your country from there. I mean, I never got a gold medal in the World Cup. I'd actually got a silver there. And this time we didn't get to, my partner and I didn't get to play Frank Palco. Didn't get to play John and Eric to the final, and they beat us in the final. And so I got my silver medal there. But yeah, that was, we'd beaten, in the teams event, we beat Scotland to get in there against USA, and they beat us there. And, so we ended up collecting a few silvers, but yeah, never got the gold, and it was something I always wanted. But playing for your country, wearing your blazer, wearing the green and gold. As I said, I grew up here. I knew nothing of anything else Australian as far as I was concerned. No, I loved it. But the whole crowd was behind me. I come out and it's like you got 3,500 people cheering from you. Whereas when I was playing in Scotland, I had 3,000 people cheering against you. I had them on my side, Richard. You know, it was lovely.
I mean, you didn't get the gold medals, but they were, 1985 was the first time any Australian players had got to a final, and you managed to do it twice in the teams and the men's pairs. So, geez, in a sense, that was still a big step for the country.
Yeah, Jockey got me last eight in the singles. So I didn't have a bad year in 85. Then, of course, we got to go to Denmark in 87. So, but there was a few other things that went on before that, but you always want to play well and when you represent your country, you know, that's the thing. It's not, you're playing for yourself, you're playing for your country and your teammates and the captain and everybody there. It's a great thrill.
And I know that the teams final in 85, the American players were very fired up because going in they were written off in a sense because they'd not picked Nicky Varachkal and Jerry Umberger, and everyone thought, oh, well, they've not picked their two best players. They're not going to do very well. And, of course, finals tied at 6-6, and then they power through to win it 9-6. So a big moment for them.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, it happened to us in Canada too. We got rid of beat the English team and then got into the final against Canada and that team. But they had the crowd behind them, 1,000 people, I tell you. That was hard. That was hard.
In 1987, you went to the World Cup in Denmark. 1988 was another exceptional year for you, and probably some of the, in terms of the big tournament, some of the best results you had. Again, the World Championship, you didn't quite get as far as probably you would have hoped. But again, like you mentioned, you lost to Phil Taylor in 1990. 1995, you ended up losing to Richie Burnett, who won the whole thing. 1988, you lost to Bob Anderson, who went to win on the whole trophy. So at least you knew you were often losing to the very best player in the field.
All in all, I had a look back. I played in 11 World Championships and 6 times out in the first round and 5 times out in the second round. But in the years that I was prepared and really fighting hard, and I thought I was going to do it, was 88 when Bob beat me. But I remember I had Darce put him away and I blew it. You know, you got to hit that double. That's what it's all about. And I missed it. But just always wanted to do my best there, and just for some reason I just could never get it happening at the embassy. It was just something that, like we called it, we all called it the embassy back then. It was the World Championships, yeah. I don't know why I couldn't get it going, but as I said, I just think I just tried too hard. I have a lot of memories. 88, of course. We had the World Grand Prix in Japan. Eric beat me in the final, but I beat some good players, Rob McKenzie from Scotland and Paul Lim, John Lowe. The last few games I played to get to play Eric in the final, Eric beat Bob. And I thought, I'm in here. And Eric just, again, another one, no matter what I did, they just outscored me, outplayed me. I was a bit embarrassed with that one, actually. I played so well to get there. Maybe I played my final against John Lowe in the semi. And, yeah, never mind. I tried every time I went on the stage, don't worry.
The Tokyo World Grand Prix I wanted to ask you about, because, of course, that, at the time, was the biggest prize fund of any darts competition in the world by quite a long way. And I remember I spoke to Mike Gregory a few weeks ago, but he remembered just walking in and seeing some of the Japanese players who he'd never seen before, and they were just hitting 180 for fun in practice, and he was thinking, blimey, this is going to be a lot harder than I thought. What was that whole tournament and spectacle like, and how much money did you actually win in the end?
Look, I was like Mike. We all walked in there when the actual tournament was on. They put us up in the Sheraton Grand Tokyo Bay. I mean, it was just... I rang the organisers up and I said, who am I sharing with? And they said, oh, no one, that's your room. I had this room with two double beds and a single bed in it. And it was just massive. And they looked after us like, couldn't believe. We get down for the event. And like Mike said, we're watching these guys. I remember Hiroshi, Watanabe, Tanada, a few other players. And we're watching them just going hour after hour. And they were just hitting 180s, 140s. Maybe they tried too hard. And I don't think one of the Japanese won. When you got through, they gave everybody their money. But everyone stayed there. And at the end, Eric and I then had to go, after the final, had to go up to the room and meet some people. So there's a bit of bowing going on. And we go in there, we met Mr. Pentax, and he gave us the watch, a camera. Mr. Zittison, he gave us a lovely watch, and sitting on the table are these two bags. And Eric and I look at each other and look at the bags, and a bit more bowing going on, and they hand us over these bags, and we look in and it's cash. And he had 10 million yen and I had 7 million yen. So I rang up my wife and I said, I'm a millionaire. I'm staying here. But don't worry about it. By the time I got home, she'd spent it. Bought a house and a car by the time I got home. Oh, no, that was a bit of an amazing thing. The dinner was fantastic. The whole thing. And I didn't know, even though the cameras are there, I'd never actually seen anything till only a couple of weeks ago when somebody said, oh, here's you playing Eric in Japan. I said, there isn't anything. And they said, yeah, here it is. And I saw it. And I... I mean, it's 32 years ago, and I didn't realise there was anything out there of it. It was really good to sit back and watch it. Eric tells a little story that he filled me up on bourbon, but I knew what he was doing. I knew what I was doing. I still just didn't have it right against him. He was still my idol. Of course, I would have liked to have won. I do class myself as a winner. I always push very hard to win. One of my tournaments here, the Australian Grand Masters, I waffle on 80s, 90s and 2000s. Beat Tony David in the final in 2002. And then we come over to England and he goes on and wins the World Championship, you know. I drew Merv that year. Merv King first round and Tony fixed him up second round, so... I don't know what it was. Maybe I just tried too hard. But I'd love to have gone better. I did then have one crack at the PDC one at Ali Pally. All I'm doing was praying I didn't draw someone who was in the Premier League, but no, I drew Adrian Lewis. So again, I got up there. I took a set off him, and I took legs in every set, but he was just too strong, just too good, just so used to being on the TV and up there on stage, where I hadn't been over for quite a while. So, as I said, 2002, so it was 7 years before I went back, and by then my drive and everything had sort of gone. I was getting a bit tired of it all. As much as I love the game, there's times where you sort of got to step back now and let the other guys come through, you know.
Looking back at 1988, you got to the MFI, World Match Play semi-finals for the second time. That was a special tournament for you.
Yeah, no, I'd always did well in the MFI. I think it was 86, I beat Mike Gregory and did really well, actually, in that one. And then I beat John Lowe to play Eric in the semi, Eric again. thinking, yeah, I'm going to go well. Clopped another one off him. He also got me in New York, win the New York Challenge Champions. I think it was 89. He beat me in the final. But along the way, I got players like Barry Twomlow and Paul Lim. People like Barry Twomlow, he was the guy, he was Mr. Dart, I called him. And to actually beat him, I was very happy. Who else? I got Richie Gardner, I took out, and a few others, and then Paul Lim semi-final. Got to Eric thinking, right, at this time, buddy, I'm flying. Bang, give it to me again. 6-2 or something like that, I think he beat me. Bloody Eric.
But in 1989, you became world number two. Was that, considering you're in Australia and obviously travelling was a lot more difficult, was that a really proud moment for you?
Oh, it was. November 82. To see my name in front of Eric and Phil, there's only Bob Anderson in front of me. I worked very hard. I mean, I was like a tennis player or a golfer. I mean, I did it from Australia, but I was, well, as I said, went to Canadian Open, the Swedish Open, and the British Open, and Hong Kong, New Zealand, Malaysia. You know, I was everywhere, you know, living out of a suitcase and airports. And to get myself there, I was a very proud moment. That's something I'm very proud of, to get there. I'm not sure how many other Australians have got that high up. I think Simon's got close with us. I think he got fourth. To get to second was a big thing for me. It really was. I really worked hard. I think I did something like 15 different countries and 5.5 times around the world to get that. So it was a lot of hard work, you know. But, yeah, that was a very pleasurable moment. And then I had the beauty of Bob coming out to Australia to do exhibitions, of course. Then they number one and number two in the world. and to get the people in, you know, for the exhibitions. And we had a great time. And I tucked him up a few times in the exhibitions. And that's when we went back to Lakeside. And we're playing him in Lakeside. And I'm getting him again. And he turns around and he goes, "Well, not a dart, he's dead now, mate." I had a dart at double 12 and three at double 6. I missed him and he peaked and then he went on to win. I think it was about 88, 89, somewhere around that time. Yeah, but I kept drawing all the great players and I got no qualms about that. They were the guys you had to beat. Yeah, that MFI, the match play to beat John Lowe, of course, we ended up having one of those games where it was three sets all, 5 legs all, last leg. I've come in there with a 12 data after he's missed the bull. I've gone a 1-6-1 out of the bull. But, I mean, I've been doing that sort of all the time, doing it in exhibitions and everything, you know. You get in there and finally crack it up over on TV like I should have been doing. I don't know why that tournament was okay for me, but just couldn't get it going. World Championships.
Your final BDO World Championship, as you said, was 2002. And, of course, you did go out in the first round, but was that a proud moment for you when, you know, Tony David became the first Australian to win a world championship? And of course,
oh yeah, gosh yes, I was broken his wheelchair. I mean, he'd done, people over here just still don't quite understand what he did, and the players that have been there before and understanding that it's such a big thing and so hard, so difficult to play over a week, every game, every night, get up there, prepare yourself. You know, as it starts, of course, you play, have a break, and then it's boom, 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 towards the end. It was just phenomenal what he did, and I was very proud of him. I only thought Simon was going to do it until Mark Webster got him, wasn't it, Mark Webster? But yeah, and then he did it again against Phil, and I thought he was going to win that as well, and the PDC won, but never mind. And you can't win them all.
But after that BDO one, what was it that motivated you to really push to try and get to the PDC World Championship? You had a couple of near misses in the Oceanic Masters before winning it in 2008, and then, of course, as you mentioned before, playing Adrian Lewis.
I think I knew I was getting towards the end of my time, and I thought, I'll give it one more crack, and if I'm going to give it one more crack, I've got to be serious about it. A couple of times in the way we run our circuit here, you either had to win the circuit or come first in the circuit, or win the Oceanic Masters. I kept getting second or third in the circuit. So I thought, well, the best thing I need to do is win this Oceanic, and got awfully close to that, and then finally did win it, in beat Warren Parry in the final from New Zealand. As we all know, Warren's a dip. So got one over him and got my chance to go, and yeah, Drew Lewis. That was a very proud moment for me internally. I knew it was my last chance. I knew I had to get in there and have a go. But, I got there, I just felt underprepared. I thought I'd done enough, but I wasn't. And Adrian was just, you know, I was just standing behind watching his throw, and he was just phenomenal. You know, I was thinking, gee. I hope people felt like that when they were playing me 20 years ago. No, I enjoyed the whole experience. It was fantastic. I mean, I know Muswell Hill very well. Of course, that's where I used to live when I stayed in England. And so I knew Alexander Palace, where it was off the Broadway, and I know that area very well. And, yeah, not far from Ollie's place. And the last few years when I went there for the BDO, I used to stay there at Ollie's house, and you know, I was treated like I was one of their family. And that's what Darce was like back then. It was a bit family. You know, we felt like a family. And you could see these guys, and I'd stay there for as long as I could and played in as many events as I could, and then head off back to Australia for the warmth because I'd get cold. The snow would start in February, and I go, sorry, guys, I'm out of here. But, yeah, no, I loved it. I played county for Surrey. I played in a couple of league matches in London and that, and I used to play out of Crystal Palace. And I enjoyed it, enjoyed every part of it. I never changed it.
And on that Oceanic tour, one of the players you often came up against and perhaps came up behind was Paul Nicholson, and he wrote an article a couple of months ago where he was talking about the most underrated darts players of all time, and one of them was you. And he said that he felt if you'd been a British-based player, you would definitely have won some of those major titles that eluded you. It must be nice to be so well thought of by one of your peers.
Yeah, well, it is. I didn't know he said that. I did hear him on one interview there saying that he had trouble beating me. And I know he did because he never beat me. I beat him every time we played. I played him in a few finals, and he's a lovely lad and a very good friend. And I did enjoy playing darts against Paul. And I didn't know he'd said that, but maybe I should have moved and actually stayed in England. But in the early 90s, my son was born. And this is when sort of I started to come out. So, which is a genetic disorder. And it's very hard to be off overseas all the time and leave my wife behind to do it all the time, you know, look after him and lift him in and out of bars and so on and so forth. So, yeah, my priorities changed and it became family rather than darts when I was a single man and off playing darts. And it came for me. I thought, well, I'll give it one more go. As I did, I got there, and I was very proud of the effort to get there. I really had to work hard.
And how is your son now?
Not too bad. He's 20, coming up to his 27th birthday very soon. And, he's wheelchair bound, so. But, it's okay. He's going very well. We haven't seen him much, obviously, with this COVID-19. He lives his own place, but we can't see him because I didn't want to, not see that much as we have been, because I didn't want anything, you know, to get at his disease. His immune system's not very good, so for him it's to get it. But I keep popping over there. I just turn up every Sunday and say g'day. Yeah, no, he's a good kid, good kid.
And I know you still play a little bit of darts now. I think it was the Australian Grandmasters you got to the quarterfinal last year. But looking back on your career, what would you say is your favourite memory?
Oh, gosh. Look, I've thought about this so many times. I really can't pin one. I mean, 83, winning the Scottish Open. I mean, getting selected for Australia in 82. Beating John, beating Eric, beating Phil Taylor. I can chuck all them in there. Even beating Mike Gregory in the match play was a really good game. I don't know. I think representing my country was one of the best. And I get up there in Brisbane and making two of the finals, because we really, really pushed the team. I was only a young fella, and I loved it. I just loved it. I just wish... I don't worry about the gold medal too much. I've got plenty of silver and a couple of bronze ones. Can't win them all.
But a big thank you for your time today, Russ. I really appreciate it. And it's been nice looking back on your career. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Appreciate the call, and I hope it was okay. As I said, I would have liked to have done better, but hey, you know, you give it your best, and I'm missing all the guys over there, you know. Got a lot of friends, and I'm going to try and get over and say g'day at least one more time, just for a visit and go for a watch. Anyway, we'll catch up then, mate, and have a beer.
Sounds like a good idea to me. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Russell, a tremendous player with a tremendous story. As he said, he eased up playing internationally in the 1990s because his son, who was 27 and the weekend just gone, was born, and he had trisome 18 Edwards syndrome, which is a genetic disorder. And I hope I pronounced that correctly, but essentially Russell wanted to spend more time with his family and more time helping to look after his son. But he came back a little later on. He consistently played in Australia, was a regular figure at the big events. And then, you know, in the noughties, he gave it a really good crack at on the PDC side, and eventually was able to play at that PDC World Championships. I mean, such is Russell's impact on the sport in Australia. He actually had a tournament named after him. In 2005, the DPA, Dart Players Australia executive, approached him and asked him if they could use his name. Russell told me he assumed it was for, you know, advertising and promotion and so on, but it was actually for the creation of an event, the Russell Stewart Classic. First year it was played, 2005, Russell presented the trophy to Anthony Fleet, who would play at the BDO World Championships, and Anthony actually beat Russell in the quarterfinals that year. The next 2 years, the title was won by Simon Whitlock, with Russell losing in the semis in 2006, and then the final to Simon in 2007, before Russell actually presented the trophy to himself in 2008 when he won it. The Russell Stewart Classic was one of the longest running competitions in the DPA Tour, but when they moved to the Grand Prix system, it was abandoned in 2018, and as things stand, the last winner was Corey Cadby back in 2017. Russell doesn't play much more, really. He did do the Australian Grand Masters last year because it was his 35th year. He'd only missed two at the time, and he'd won the tournament six times. So it obviously meant a lot to him, and luckily it's based in his hometown as well, so he didn't have too far to travel. And he has been for the last 10 years and is still doing so. He's the captain of the DPA men's, women's and youth teams. And he actually told me he finds that more intimidating than playing on stage. Russell's a tremendous bloke, and I hope if you've got this far that you enjoyed my chat with him and Ask Podcast of the Month, this one. You can check out, you know, all the other ones from this month in the Golden Arrow series with Ray Stubbs, Russell's compatriot Wayne Weening, and the three-time world champion John Lowe, as well as the Dutch special episode of the podcast with Jacques Nieuwland and Marco Meyer. Thanks for listening, as always. Your support is greatly appreciated, and I'll be back next week with episode 14 of the Golden Arrow series with the silverback, Mr. Tony O'Shea. I've got lots more exciting content planned for August. Until next time.